Welcome back to The Devil Within, A Season in Hell. We have another bonus episode for you today as it relates to those 13 months of terror in New York in the late 70s. In the immediate aftermath of the arrest of David Berkowitz in August of 1977, several things happened or began happening all at once. First, the city was able to let out a collective sigh of relief after months of fear and uncertainty and anxiety. It all melted away the moment they saw that goofy, chubby dude smiling for the cameras on his perp walk into the precinct. The second thing was the wheels of justice began turning with regard to Berkowitz's prosecution for his crimes. But in the background, there was another important facet of the story that was also in the works. The publishing powerhouse Simon & Schuster had been closely following the Son of Sam murders, and once the bad guy was in custody, they did what they do. They went after the story, confident that there was a bestseller on the horizon. What Simon & Schuster did was offer David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, a $250,000 advance, which is almost $1 million in today's money, and a profit-sharing position for the rights to publish his life story. The idea of a man who had inflicted such pointless mayhem on an entire city getting paid to tell his story obviously didn't sit well. People lost their minds, actually. So much so that lawmakers in New York City and upstate in Albany, the capital of New York, moved quickly and enacted an entire slate of legislation that would come to be known as the Son of Sam laws. Basically, laws that prevent criminals from profiting from their crimes. These laws would see a rough road ahead as they sought to protect the dignity of victims and prevent bad guys from getting rich. In studio today to discuss this is Los Angeles entertainment attorney and host of the podcast, The Prevailing Narrative, Matt Belinsky. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How have you been? Good?
Doing fantastic, Brandon. How's 2024 treating you so far?
So far, so good. It's nice
looking
to see
good
you.
On you. Absolutely. Same here.
It's nice to see you again. Matt and I go back. I was one of the original producers of his podcast, The Prevailing Narrative. I stepped away from the show in the wake of some life, somehow things go,
you know, in corporate media, you never know the trials and travails, but we're still here right now cranking away.
Yes, we are. So like I said, it's nice to see you and to offer your expert opinion because I will quickly be exposed for not knowing anything about the law. So thank you very much. All right. So what I wanted to know basically is, first of all, as a law student, were you exposed to these laws?
Yes, I went to UCLA, so obviously the curriculum there, not entirely focused on entertainment and media, but you'd be surprised how many different facets of the law end up impacting somebody involved in entertainment and media. It's not just intellectual property. There's a lot of stuff in terms of litigation and criminal law and constitutional law, which is what the body of law we're discussing here today. And that just happens to involve media figures or situations that are media centric because they became high profile enough to make their way through the court system.
Okay, so you practice mostly what?
I don't really practice a ton of traditional entertainment at this point, let's be honest. The traditional entertainment industry as existed when I was in law school doesn't really exist anymore. It's shot off in, you know, however many different directions. So I do, you know, for instance, Pluto TV was a company that I was heavily involved in, and sure, that's television and broadcasting, but digital streaming, I do some of that, but, you know, now a lot of consumer products and technology, and a lot of that has some sort of content or digital component, but it's not broadcast television or feature film as existed, you know, for decades.
Have you had any run-ins with these laws at all
I
as
have.
A professional?
There was one client of mine that was, did a lot of Cuban Miami-based true crime. You know, a lot of the, a lot of their slate was true crime emanating from the various characters that you find in the criminal world in Miami, whether Cuban, Colombian, you know, the drug wars in the
Scarface
late
70s. Type of stuff.
A lot of Scarface stuff. And here's the thing: see, beyond Scarface, which was, you know, the Mariel Boatlift and the offshoots and the progeny. That was the progeny of a lot of that transpired in the Miami crime world. But man, there is just the rogues gallery of characters that have. That have come through Miami's ports and just that had some sort of criminal. If you were a criminal, and people think just in terms of the United States, that people escaped to Florida, but it's also South America. If you were involved in some shady stuff in the gold mining world in Venezuela, believe it or not, you make your way to Miami. And just anything that you can find in that world seems to have some Miami connection. And this came up a couple times when we were trying to determine what deals we could make with the subjects of those incidents, because you want to hear the story from the source. You want to, right. you don't want to get it secondhand. And if you're going to go cut a deal with somebody and you want those interviews and you want their source material and they want to get paid for it, you got to make sure it's legal.
And were you hamstrung by these laws? Did you?
A little bit.
Really?
Because believe it or not, Florida is one of the few states that's upheld the Son of Sam laws.
Really?
Yeah. Oddly enough. So that was a difficult workaround. I'll leave it up to your imagination how we worked around it in some regards.
I think I know, because I had to work around them.
Yeah.
I did a show in New York, okay, about an art gallery in New York that sold tens of millions of dollars of fake paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The woman who did time for it was out, wanted to talk to us for the show, couldn't. Because of Son of Sam laws. Okay.
Yeah.
So we're like, okay, I guess we're screwed. She goes, no, I'll talk to you. We're like, okay. She goes, but you have to talk to my daughter.
Yep.
My daughter has to clear you first, and her consulting fee is $20,000.
Yeah, it's always some, not that that's how we solved it, but
right.
That's some, right. Some variation of that solution.
And it's like everybody in the room knew that that money was going to her, that it wasn't going to her daughter.
Yeah.
But that's a very obvious and really simple workaround.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a way to just thumb your nose at the law.
Which is another, and we'll get into it, but as many laws that are kind of hastily constructed out of a media blitz are somewhat ill-conceived, even if there's a rational justification for it out of a notion of fairness, but don't really mesh with underlying law, and they become a little bit of a whack-a-mole in that there's always an easy workaround, and that would seem to be the case with these Son of Sam laws. And you know, the best piece that I read in even doing a little extra research on this topic was the ultimate thesis of the piece was you literally cannot construct a law that will fully withstand constitutional scrutiny in this regard.
And that seems very cut and dry. And what was their rationale behind that? Because the First Amendment?
The First Amendment, in that essentially trying to nail down on the connection and trying to narrowly tailor a law around that ties to the content, the nature of the content, because that's the whole idea. You're not trying to punish people for, giving their thoughts on their Super Bowl picks, right? You're trying to punish them. And the only way that anything would stand up under law would be as if it's somewhat narrowly tailored to the speech, benefiting from speech that has some connection to the crime, right?
Right.
But you can think about it with OJ's If I Did It, for instance, and we'll get to that in more detail. Yeah. But you can go look at If I Did It, and you're like, okay, that's content that's pretty on the nose in terms of whatever money you make from that book, you're profiting from the commission of the crime, or at least the allegation of the commission of the crime. Listen, he wasn't prosecuted, right?
Right.
He wasn't convicted. However, theoretically, let's say if the law was the content simply can't be a description of the crime necessarily, well then, okay, O.J. Simpson could theoretically go write a more extensive or have someone write a more extensive biography or autobiography that makes this one chapter out of 15, and all of a sudden you said, oh, okay, well, this is broader, that's just incidental to my general life story, and falls outside the statute.
Yeah. Right. Well, I see that. So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the big problems with the laws as written.
Correct.
Was how broad they were.
Right? Correct. Well, how broad they were, but also, is there a way to identifiably and demonstrably narrow it in terms of identifying, you know, the content? And that's what do you want to get into the genesis of it so everybody has context?
Yeah, in a second. Okay. Because the case that made it to the Supreme Court wasn't the Berkowitz case.
There was no Berkowitz case because he never took a deal.
Because he never did it.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So it was the Henry Hill book with Nicholas Pileggi, the book that became the movie Goodfellas.
Correct.
Okay. And that made it all the way to the Supreme Court in 1991. Yes. So is that what you wanted to discuss?
Well, we'll get the genesis of that, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, as we see quite often, and particularly more these days because there's more media, because of social media, thus more reactivity to media. However, there was no more media-centric. I mean, the Son of Sam, as I'm sure you've described, the Son of Sam murder and the incident soaked up all the oxygen in the room.
Everything.
At the time. All of society was completely obsessed by it. So when the notion arose of financial offers being made to David Berkowitz to tell his story and profit from being the son of Sam, obviously society had a rational reaction to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And an outrage that we cannot allow this to happen, and thus some legislation needs to be passed to prevent it. And here's the interesting thing in terms of Berkowitz is these offers were made, but he never accepted any of them. Right. Mm. This was based just this arose just out of him receiving these offers.
Right. And the potential of a deal being made.
The potential. He didn't even accept any of them.
Right.
So New York goes ahead and constructs this legislation. The idea being that criminals should not profit from filtering their story through media. They should not be paid in response for some media expression of their crime.
Could I stop you there for a second?
Sure.
Because what I'm interested in is that was there any, and I don't, there might, you might not have an answer to this, but was there any ambition with these laws as deterrence, right? Like say I'm broke and I've got a family to feed. And I decide I'm going to go create a string of, pull off a bunch of crimes and then sell the story.
From what I've gathered, that was not a conscious motive.
Okay, cool.
It could have been a tertiary motive, but it was definitely not the primary one. The primary motive was, okay, people go and commit crimes and then are going to go get paid to tell the story about those crimes. No, we're not having that.
Gotcha.
That is not fair. It was out of fairness. Unfortunately, we've got a thing called the First Amendment, and it protects the vast majority of speech out there, but not all speech, right?
Of course.
You know, well, we won't get into the yelling fire in a theater because everybody is yanked and distorted the interpretation of that case 7 ways to Sunday.
Yes.
Or 6 ways to Sunday.
And the First Amendment only protects you from reprisals from your government, not from like your employer. Right?
Sure. But then there's also, but this is the court system. There's also a lot, there's some places that the First Amendment falls where something becomes, particularly in the age of social media, where there are institutions that are acting quasi-governmental.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
Anyways. Yep. So they enact these laws, oddly enough, never even applied to Berkowitz because he never accepts a deal. Mm-hmm. They were mostly applied to Mark David Chapman, who was John Lennon's murderer. Okay. It was something like 20 times someone tried to pay Mark David Chapman and it got shot down every time. Nobody really, you know, makes too much of a stink about this until the early 90s. Nicholas Pileggi goes and writes this book on the life story of Henry Hill, the gangster. It's called Wise Guys. And Martin Scorsese finds it extremely interesting and decides to go make the movie Goodfellas. And Simon & Schuster, which is a Deep Pockets, a heavy hitter publishing house, maybe the heaviest hitter, decides that, all right, this is ridiculous. These are stories that need to be told. Unfortunately, Henry Hill, he was a bad guy, but now he's a good guy and he did his time and he, you know, turned on his compatriots. And I'm sorry, these are newsworthy stories and he should be able to be compensated. And we should be able to be compensated for telling this story. And they take the case all the way up to, okay, so interestingly enough, originally, the district court ruled in favor of the state against Simon & Schuster and upheld the Son of Sam law.
Right, it's the New York Victims, Crime Victims Fund.
The Crime Victims Fund, right?
Okay.
So the New York, the district court, the initial court, the local court upheld the Son of Sam laws originally, but they used a different standard for determining whether this impingement or infringement on the First Amendment was sufficient, because they said that this law only incidentally infringed on the First Amendment, because it's not saying you can't say it. It's just saying you can't make money from it.
So that's undue financial burden is how they kind of
that was not the standard.
Okay.
So the standard here that the lower court implemented was called the O'Brien test. And the standard was, has the law been enacted within the constitutional power of the government? Does it further an important or substantial governmental interest unrelated to the suppression of free speech? And the incidental restriction on First Amendment freedom is no greater than is essential to that governmental interest. So fascinating. That's quite an elaborate standard. Nevertheless, it is not, that's not considered strict scrutiny. That is not the highest standard, right? So what they're saying is you're not punishing the speech directly. You're simply imposing a financial, I think this is why it wasn't the standard that was eventually used, but they believe that it was incidentally impacting the First Amendment, not directly impacting the First Amendment. Then the court, Simon & Schuster appeals. They take it to a New York district court. The New York district court rules against the lower court in terms of which standard to use, but upholds the ruling. So they say the district court decides that what applies now, that it is a direct impingement on free speech and thus must be subjected to what's called strict scrutiny. So strict scrutiny means that that the law has to serve a compelling societal governmental interest and be narrowly tailored tailored to serve that interest. Those are the two prongs of strict scrutiny. However, the district court upholds the law and says that it is, that it does meet strict scrutiny, right? And Simon and Schuster says, well, how the hell does it even meet that standard? They decide to take it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has a decidedly different view on it. One of the few Supreme Court rulings that was unanimous, 8-0, they rule in favor of Simon and Schuster and rule the New York law unconstitutional. They deem it both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. The over-inclusiveness ruling, I think, makes all the sense in the world. I'm still... I stared at it a bunch of times, and I'm still scratching my head at their the rationale, the reasoning behind the claim that it was under inclusive. But essentially, first, the statute was ruled over inclusive because it applied to any work that expressed the author's thoughts or recollections of the crime, whether or not the author had been accused or convicted. Because crime-related expression itself is not criminal, writing about a crime should not be should be protected under the First Amendment. Wow. So, what are we dealing with here? One, and the examples, and this is the best argument against these laws. And Day O'Connor kept on going back to this. You are essentially preventing, this law essentially prevents anybody who is a criminal from profiting off their life story whatsoever. Now let's look at some people who were once criminals who then had life stories that were worth telling and profiting on. They use examples like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. Malcolm X was a youth criminal, did a lot of bad things, and then, you know, turned his life around and became a paragon of the community, or at least not a violent one, depending on who you talk to. And the examples of that are endless. I mean, you could even look at it now. I mean, Marky Mark was a criminal.
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Are these laws supposed to prevent Mark Wahlberg from telling his life story? I mean, technically the law would have was a case to be made that Marky Mark could not write his autobiography or profit from it because it included references to his criminality that he was convicted for. So that's the best argument against these laws. So they claimed it was over-inclusive, and also the law was hastily drafted, so it also only referred to having been convicted of a crime. It didn't even mention that you were convicted of that you could be prevented from profiting from telling the story of the crime you were convicted for.
Right.
Right. So it's a little hastily drafted. And then the second piece that I mentioned, that claiming that it was under-inclusive because it imposed a financial burden on individuals related to the content of their speech, where it would redirect the income from that expressive activity, but not income from other activities.
Right.
But okay, what's your take on that? Because I find that to be odd reasoning. Of course, a law that is intended to prevent someone from profiting from the description of their crime, why on earth would it address anything other than any activity other than being paid for discussing that crime in media? It's like a strange reasoning.
Right. And so then they, in the wake of that, states amended these laws, and there are different versions of it that are still on the books in about 40 states.
Sure.
Where there's some that were more narrowly tailored and some that...
Yeah, so, okay, so New York revised the law in 2001. And to be perfectly honest, I don't think... It was not a massive deviation from the original law, but you know, a couple things that the new 2001 New York law did, it applied to only a limited number of crimes, which on the one hand, okay, that narrows the scope of the law, but it doesn't narrow it rationally because, okay, you're saying it's okay to profit from describing stealing candy, you know, robbing a convenience store, but you can't profit from robbing a bank. For instance, like that's from a constitutional perspective, that's a strange distinction.
Sure.
It also, and you know, probably where it's a little bit more on the money is that it extended the statute of limitations for victims, because that's the other compelling interest. It's not just the two compelling interests, societal interests served by these laws are one, to prevent criminals from profiting, but also to compensate victims.
Right.
So in compensating victims, they extend the statute of limitations, not from the time, having it begin not at the time of the crime, but having it begin at the time of the profit. Right?
That makes sense.
That piece of it made sense. Also, they created a very arbitrary $10,000 threshold. So if you make less than $10,000 from telling your story, then
you
nobody cares.
It.
Right? Once again, doesn't seem to have any constitutional relevance, but New York clearly, the New York legislature clearly wanted this law to be in place and was going to kind of chip around the edges to, it's kind of like trying to chop, you know, nude scenes out to get an R rating instead of an X rating type of thing.
Of my questions here is that, in the wake of this Supreme Court case, it went from, and again, my fucking caveman understanding of this, profits of a crime, okay, which is defined narrowly, to funds of a convicted person. Like any money that they got would go into the fund, into an escrow account to pay the victims or their dependents.
Yeah, and this was just a bit of a way to head off some of what we described earlier about trying to engineer ways to pay, you know, get paid around that, which fine. But I don't think that really changed the nature of these laws at all, which is once again, you commit a crime. The notion is if you tell the story of that crime or some, you know, in some regard, you shouldn't be able to make money off it because then you're also, it's incidental or an attendant to the crime and you're profiting from the crime. Right. So I think the 2001 New York statute has a lot more kind of cosmetic changes to it. I don't think it really addressed what the Supreme Court in shooting it down originally had in mind. But that New York law thus far has been upheld. But it's also because it might be coming up for challenge, and this is interesting. So Anna Delvey, or Anna Sorokin, or whatever the hell her real name is.
Okay. The fake heiress.
The fake heiress. It may come to a head around her because she was forced to disgorge profits from her Netflix show.
Right.
The Netflix show, pretty on the nose directly about, we're telling the story of this woman who committed the crime, and this is the crime she committed, and everything else around that is kind of supplemental. So that she did not challenge the law in that regard when those profits
and
were disgorged. She paid. Yeah.
Did Netflix have to pay part of their profits as well?
I believe Netflix had to as
well. Wow.
Yeah, they didn't challenge it. However, Anna, I think she's already has. I think she's launched a podcast. So you can make the case that the Netflix show that's pretty much just about Anna Delvey being a criminal and that's why people are watching it, but podcast, let's say she does 100 episodes and like she only mentions the crime on 4 of them. Like, do you only disgorge 4%? the profits right. on those episodes? Do you say, listen, the only reason anyone gives a shit about this woman
because
is because
of your
she's a crime? So this is, you see the difficulty.
Absolutely.
You see the difficulty of interpretation and enforcement. And this people are speculating that if the state hasn't tried to go grab the money from this podcast yet, but they are speculating they will. And they're speculating that if Anna Delvey or her podcast company or whoever else is financially backing her has their druthers and is so inclined that they will make bones about this.
And they'll challenge it.
So we'll see.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Happy January. Are you tired yet of all those New Year, New You offers clogging up your feed? I am. But hey, if that gets you motivated, then good for you. Go for it. But what if a whole new you isn't necessary? What if you're pretty stoked about some areas of your life? Maybe that relationship you've been working on is really thriving, or the job you committed to is finally working out. If you're looking to maximize what you're doing right, therapy might be the answer. A good therapist can help you define your strengths, get specific, and avoid the extreme resolutions that are difficult to maintain. BetterHelp is online therapy that adapts to your schedule. After they learn a little bit about you, you'll be matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists whenever you want for no additional charge. I've been telling my audience for 3 seasons now how I've benefited from therapy my entire adult life. So if you think therapy might be right for you, consider giving BetterHelp a try. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/DevilWithin today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/DevilWithin. Okay, so my other question now is, if like the original kind of body that was trying to enforce these, the New York Crime Victims Fund, wouldn't they want money to be generated so then they can pay the victims, right? And wouldn't that be superseded by our civil code? Doesn't that counterfeit all of this stuff?
That is the, and this also is very runs parallel to, for instance, bankruptcy. And this is something that you're seeing right now with a gentleman named Billy McFarlane of the Fire Festival. And Billy McFarlane, you know, who I had on my podcast.
Yeah, I remember.
He's at least, you know, I don't know how much he's eaten into it, but when I had him on the podcast, he owed $25 million. This is $25 million arising out of fraud. It's not dischargeable. But he's out there and he's making money and he's generating money. And the notion is the more money that Billy generates, we're going to give him just enough to keep him motivated and the rest goes to the victims. And that's how everybody wins here. And then there's
that makes sense to me
a lot, right?
Okay.
You're trying to strike a similar balance under the Son of Sam laws. But it's been difficult to strike that balance, but you'd figure, okay, you figure they'd land somewhere like the Billy situation in bankruptcy.
Right.
You can go make money off it, but the vast majority, we're going to let you keep enough that it's worth it for you to do it, and we're going to take the rest and we're going to give it to the victims. I haven't seen that many instances of that so far. Where you have seen this intersect, and which does make sense, intersect with basic civil law and civil judgments is the O.J. Simpson case where, you know, it, aside from the Son of Sam laws and O.J. Simpson profiting, the family of Ron Goldman filed a wrongful death suit, won that suit in civil court, and was awarded got a big award from O.J. Simpson. He was difficult to collect from, but then released this book called If I Did It. Mm-hmm. And since they already had the judgments against him, the notion is that regardless of whether it's media or otherwise, wherever O.J. Simpson is making money from, the most of that's supposed to go to the Goldmans. Right. So, of course, it would apply to this book just like it apply to if he was got a job scrubbing toilets.
Right, any job.
Exactly.
Right.
And so that's a place where it seems to make sense that if there's already a civil judgment in place and you just owe the money generally, that this will be one of the streams of income from which you have to pay back your civil judgment. And, you know, that goes through the it has the same gauntlet of issues that we described with the Billy situation and how much does OJ keep, how much goes to the Goldmans, et cetera. And that is part of the New York law that in extending the statute of limitations to bring a civil complaint, you can then, let's say a family of a victim just didn't have the money or wasn't so inclined to go and bring a civil claim against the criminal. And let's be honest, most criminals are not O.J. Simpson with big pocketbooks, or at least the appearance of big pocketbooks. They're mostly fucking broke, right? So most people don't bring civil complaints against criminals. Then if you find out that the criminal is going to go do a big book deal, okay, great. Now you have 3 years to bring the civil complaint.
Right.
So that's one aspect of the revised New York law that I think makes a lot of sense. But then to go back to the California example, strangely enough, the California Supreme Court struck down the Son of Sam legislation, but has not struck down the ruling against O.J. Simpson that he has to direct all profits from that book to the Goldman family. Possibly, and then that brings the question of, if O.J. challenged it, would O.J. win based on, you know, the California Supreme Court ruling striking down the Son of Sam law? And just, you know, as a matter of interest to everybody out there, the California court struck down the Son of Sam law in regards to one of the guys who kidnapped Frank Sinatra Jr. And was selling the movie rights to his story. And the courts ruled, listen, this is something that people are going to want to see, going to want to hear about. It's the First Amendment. You can't stop them.
It seems like a lot of amendments are involved here, like the Sixth Amendment with civil stuff, right? But they can't impose undue burdens on them. Can't take all of the money. Got to let them, like with the Fire Festival guy, right? They got to let him
earn
and live.
He's not an indentured servant. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So there's the, you know, cruel and unusual punishment thing that they have to kind of find. So it's really interesting. It's really, really interesting. And it's also, again, in my, you know, not broad or deep understanding of this, it just shows the states' rights kind of situation that we're in, because 40 states have them. That means 10 states don't.
Sure.
So in those 10 states, you could profit however you want from any crime.
One of the unique, not necessarily unique, but one of more unique than in most other sovereign states in the United States, where you have these divergent bodies of law and you're trying to figure out what is supreme, and if the federal government has passed legislation that would overrule any of that. And that sometimes pops up, you know, in the oddest of places. in interpreting these laws, for instance, in Arizona, where this popped up, and the law wasn't struck down, but it was struck down on procedural grounds, not on constitutional grounds in Arizona. This is around a gentleman named Sammy the Bull Gravano.
Yes.
Yeah. So Sammy the Bull Gravano was the number two, he was the lieutenant for Mafia Kingpin John Gotti, mm-hmm. probably the highest profile guy, a mafia figure ever to turn state's evidence and turn on the mafia. Yep. Reinvented himself as one of the first guys, you know, importing Molly into Arizona in the early 2000s. I have my thoughts on that.
Jesus Christ.
Both, you know, personal and from afar.
Yeah, of course.
Sammy was trying to tell a story. And listen, he had already done his time. He
right.
turned state's evidence. Like, listen, are you do then? If you turn on, you know, if you get immunity and you testify against the other criminals, does that mean that you should be released from this? However, apparently in Arizona, what the ruling was, the Supreme Court's appellate division ruled that the state law limiting the ability of a convicted felon to profit from the crime did not apply to federal offenses, that it only applied to civil offenses.
Wow.
Because it was the civil court didn't rule on it. I mean, the state court didn't rule on it. Also mentioned in that ruling that the plaintiff in that lawsuit did not have standing to bring the legal action because no victim of Gravano's crimes had ever filed a complaint with the board. Apparently, there's a local victim's rights board in Arizona that brought the claim, but not the victims themselves. So they ruled against it. However, the court there in Arizona explicitly mentioned that we're not ruling on the constitutional issue. We're not even addressing it. So if someone wants to go bring this claim based on infringement of the First Amendment, that we'll discuss that when you bring it. But this is just, we're just rejecting this on procedural grounds, and Sammy the Bull got to keep his money.
Jesus Christ. So if a buddy of mine wants to do a show about one of these big drug traffickers from like the Cali cartel who was living in New York, and then he escaped prosecution and is in like a non-extradition treaty country, but my buddy found him and went down there and interviewed him for like 2 weeks. And he comes back to the States to make the show. Okay, obviously the guy who's living overseas can't touch him, right? But my friend who wants to tell the story, depending on what state he was in, would be subject to the Son of Sam laws because he's a proxy for the criminal?
Theoretically, he could be. But as you see, right, in trying to determine what is the law, sometimes you don't know what the law is until someone brings a claim and gets the court to rule on it.
Yeah.
That is something that a lot of lay people are kind of blissfully unaware of, the notion that everybody knows what the law is. And just because there's precedent or just because there's a related law is that if there's even, you know, a slight factual deviation, theoretically you could bring a claim based on distinguishing characteristics or try to avoid it based on distinguishing characteristics. Someone could go try to enforce the law and say, no, those aren't distinguishing characteristics. And we don't find out what the law is until the court rules on it.
Right.
And as you're seeing it in New York, right? We're describing it right now. Like, it appears that whatever Anna Delvey did with this Netflix show, fell within the scope of the Son of Sam law there that has not yet been overturned, and she can't do what she did with the Netflix show. Do we know if the same rules apply to the podcast? And if so, how? We don't know.
Man. So it's really a lesson in hastily constructed laws.
Somewhat, yeah.
Based on the
public high-profile media
frenzy, all of that. Do you think that there's your personal opinion, is there a place for these laws in our society today?
I think I have to say yes because they're there. That's the reality, right?
Yeah,
the reality is there are some states where these laws have been upheld and they're sometimes being applied. So do I think it's entirely clear-cut that they are unconstitutional? No. The gentleman, the legal scholar whose piece I read saying that, hey, there's no way to construct one of these laws that will forever stand up under constitutional scrutiny, I think he's got a point. If you challenged every one of these laws, I don't think they'd withstand anything, because once again, it goes back to how do you tailor something both in terms of the actual legislation and the language and the interpretation that does not prevent someone or punish someone from just telling other aspects or events of their life, right? You know, because theoretically, like I said before, if the law is okay, we're just not going to let you profit from something that is limited just to describing the crime, right? Then okay, that's an easy end around. There's easy circumvention. Yeah, you just go ahead and talk about some other stuff and then stick it somewhere in the middle.
Exactly.
So that's the difficulty with these laws. I think that's what it turns on.
Wow. So we're going to be stuck, as we always are, with an imperfect system.
Yeah. You know, that's life.
Yeah, with these laws, that's interesting. I think it's hard for me to really put myself in the position of someone who would be like upset by it, right? Like if I'm a survivor of a murder victim or something like mm-hmm. that, like I think I might lose my fucking mind if the person who killed someone I love is going to go make $1 million off of it. Like that, from that point of view, I get it. Mm-hmm. From the constitutional point of view, in a vacuum, right, dispassionately, I get that as well. Someone should be able to tell their story and to talk about stuff and to do whatever. So I completely understand all of the ups and downs and ins and outs with this. And I don't think there is a clear answer.
Yeah, there's definitely not a clear answer. Yeah. And I think it really is a perfect case study of where fairness and rational expressions of the law bump up against each other.
Yeah.
You know, as you said, I mean, maybe the finest. I don't know if there's a better one than
really,
this.
Really, really interesting.
Yeah.
100%. Really, really interesting.
And you know, the fact that all these seminal cases on this subject seem to be around really interesting, high profile people. I mean, look at who we just rolled off.
Right?
Like none of these was
Sorokin,
like, oh,
OJ,
some guy
Berkowitz.
That nobody heard about.
Sammy the Bull.
Yeah.
Right?
The case in Nevada, I think, was a lower profile one that didn't really reach the public consciousness. And they actually, Nevada struck down the Son of Sam law there. But all the rest of these.
But
like,
you're right. They're all huge.
All the huge cases.
Huge cases. Right. Yeah. And like, OJ especially, I know that publisher, Judith Regan.
Okay, yeah.
And
she likes to stoke the fire.
She loves to stoke the fire. She could not give a shit about
She's
it.
She's a flamethrower.
Yeah, she really is. She really is. And I just think OJ is just such a, I mean.
Unbelievable. You were in LA in the 90s, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. Anybody out there listening, we cannot fully explain what it was like to be in LA. I mean, I was pretty young. I was in high school at the time, but like. LA in the 90s during the OJ thing, and every person knew someone that had some connection to it. It was something else.
I covered it in the last episode of this season, trying to compare that 13 months in New York, right, with the murders and with all of the strikes and with the massive blackout and the Yankees ultimately winning the World Series. And then, you know, Elvis died 4 days after Berkowitz was arrested.
Wow, I didn't know that
one.
Yeah,
like a bunch of shit going on. And I said, all right, in LA, okay, starting in 92 with the Rodney King riots, the Malibu firestorm in 93, followed by the mudslides, the Northridge quake in 94, which we just hit the anniversary of last week.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the cherry on top was the O.J. Simpson low speed chase, followed by the trial
Tupac,
of the century.
Tupac Biggie.
Tupac
thing.
Biggie happened, right? Yeah. Like all of that. But that wasn't part of that was in New York.
Sure,
Vegas,
but it's still
LA story.
LA felt it.
LA 100% felt it.
Yeah.
But to have those, all of those events, like back to back in a span of like 36 months, was fucking crazy.
Yeah. And people, crazy. Every that was how LA was discussed and framed at the time. It was like, what, LA story, like the
end times.
Yeah, not end times, no natural disaster in the past like 3 days, that type of thing. I mean, it was interesting times out here for sure.
Really, really crazy times. But so did anything that we missed, importantly, that we need to know about the Son of Sam laws?
Because
we covered a lot of stuff. And
we covered it. I mean, I think we see what we're trying to do. We see what the societal concern is that they're trying to address. We see the reason that courts have decided that even though there is a compelling interest around it, it just might not be something where you can limit speech in this regard. And we see that it's constantly evolving. It's a fluid body of law. It's fluid interpretation. It's going to come up again. Yeah. And you know, it's going to keep things interesting, and it's just, and it also says a lot in describing what, and something for people to keep in mind when a high profile incident occurs and there's outrage and people decide to pass a law, that is animated by that outrage, right? You got to be skeptical of these things, right? Society does not operate its best when reacting to high-profile outrage.
All right, I like to end these with some rapid-fire questions
that
I didn't prepare you for. Are you ready?
Love those.
I don't want you to think about it. I just want you to answer. All right, I think I know this. All right, anyway, we're going to go quick. Art museum or history museum?
History museum.
Passenger in a car, driver in a car?
Driver in a car.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
Summer or winter?
Winter.
DC or Marvel?
Don't give a fuck.
Tattoos or piercings?
Oh, God. Give a fuck about both being terrible. Although I'll go tattoos.
Godfather or Goodfellas?
Godfather, but it's close.
Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
Food truck or restaurant?
Restaurant.
Chocolate or vanilla?
Vanilla.
Rock, paper, scissor, what do you open with?
Oh man, I'm giving away my secrets here. The instinct is to go rock, but I try to like negate that instinct and go scissors.
Wow, that's deep. Okay. Where do you land on the Kennedy assassination?
I've evolved over the years. I think Oswald did it.
How about Roswell?
I don't think there's aliens.
Wow, that's
nice. Oh, no, I don't not think there's aliens. I don't think we've discovered them in the Roswell sense of the narrative.
Are we alone in the universe?
No.
Picasso or Van Gogh?
Picasso.
Warhol or Basquiat?
Warhol.
Tupac or Biggie?
Biggie.
Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
Best pizza in LA? I'm a kid from Jersey. I got to know your opinion.
I'm a simple guy. I'll go fucking Joe's, dude. Joe's is good. Joe's gets the job done.
Love it.
Yeah, yeah. But here's I'm just going to throw out. Oh, are you?
Yeah, more? That's it. No, we're okay. Done.
You got to start going instead of Goodfellas, Godfather, you got to go Goodfellas Casino because that's the tougher call. And that's the more.
It's too tough. I don't want to do that. And how to about you.
No, but I'll say it right now. I fucking said it. Casino. People.
What?
Bro, Casino is unbelievable. Casino's incredible.
Hold on.
Casino's underrated because it came after Goodfellas and people's like, nah, I can't. They're like, we can't. It's sacrilegious to say that this movie is better than Goodfellas because it's derivative of Casino's better.
Here's my thoughts on it. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah.
I think it's the best performance from Sharon Stone that we've ever had. I think she's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
I think Pesci was great. Amazing. My problem with that movie was that it was too real with Pesci and his brother's death.
I mean...
When I hear Pesci say...
You and my mom... Wait. Can we talk? Whoa. This is my mom's problem, okay? No, my mom can't do Casino because I can't watch them get killed. What? Are you a baby boomer female from New York, Brandon? I mean, she's off the hook. It's my mom and she's sensitive and whatnot.
Listen.
Whatever. They needed to get their ass beat. That's how it happened.
No, hold on. It's all... And I think I know what your mom's talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because it's one line from Pesci... Says, come on, he's still breathing.
Oh, God.
When they're throwing dirt on him.
But Brandon, that's completely separate from the quality of the film.
No, it's too good.
It's too good. Okay.
It's too real.
Okay, once again, Casino, better than Goodfellas. Okay? Casino's fucking unbelievable.
Oh, my gosh. That scene with him, with De Niro and Pesci in the desert.
Everything.
Who the fuck do you think you fucking are?
You Jew motherfucker. You
Jew motherfucker.
And I'm Jewish, so no Karens out there.
Okay. I married a Jew, so it's fine.
All right, there we go.
But still, man.
The way it's shot, Lester Diamond, come on, man.
Lester Diamond's such a great character.
Bro, Jimmy Woods, wherever you're out
there. So real. Again, so too real.
For sure.
Her love for him was so honest.
Yeah.
Right? That she would do anything for him.
For this fucking loser.
I know, for fucking loser.
And you've got this guy who's successful, has high stature, and is like, the fucking woman I love is going for this fucking pond scum. And gets his ass beat like he should have, but it doesn't even matter. Look, no, it's
she ties the daughter up to the bed to go out.
Oh man, yeah,
you know, and all ostensibly a true story, which I think is terrific.
Yeah,
and listen, it's great.
Yeah, it's fucking a masterpiece. Great.
And I think you're right. I would agree with you that I fall into the Goodfellas is a cultural touchstone. You know,
sure.
And so I would.
It just overshadows because it was so the Vegas version of Goodfellas, and Goodfellas was groundbreaking.
And only 5 years later.
Yeah. But Casino's a better movie.
It's really good.
Yeah. Are you glad we went in this direction on this chat?
It's really good, but it's too hard of a question.
Huh?
Goodfellas or Casino, people would go, whoa, you know what I mean? I want to be nice.
Okay, Casino versus Goodfellas is more esoteric question because people are expecting The Godfather versus Goodfellas.
Yeah. Yeah, the esoteric nature of people having to really kind of parse the two, like, Scorsese masterpieces might be a little... Might short circuit. I would. Yeah. I did.
And anyone under age 38 probably was, no, these fucking teeny boppers.
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up today. Love Matt, it. Let people know where they can find you. We could talk about Prevailing Narrative a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Everybody, I mean, you know, primary social media content is both my Twitter and my Instagram, MattBilinsky. Podcast, The Prevailing Narrative, available, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, typically weekly, little travel over the holidays. So have not yet broken the seal on 2024, but we'll be doing that shortly. That's another story altogether, Brandon.
Yes.
It's, you know, everything from a discussion attack on current events to 2024, certainly be political heavy, but that it's certainly not a political first podcast. Interview series with persons of interest, whether those in the social sciences, business world, what have you. This man right here, Brandon, helped me craft it, and it was a pleasure doing it with him. And
here's what I'll say about Matt and his content. He's a great follow. He's an interesting follow. He's not an easy follow. Okay. Like there's no softball shit coming at you. It is opinion heavy. This is why things are supposed to be the way they are. You'll get mad at him, but you'll find it really hard to disagree because the arguments are very, very well thought out.
Thank you.
And it's not that he's afraid to have an argument. I just don't know how many people you've run into that have won an argument. You know,
not many.
Right. Listen, I'm not producing your show anymore. I'm not jacking you off here. It's just true.
Thank you.
I was there on tons of your interviews. Okay. And I would always say the same thing when I'd come back on afterwards. I'm taking notes. I'm learning shit here.
Thank you.
You know,
man.
Really learning stuff. And I always had fun warming you up, trying to say things that would piss you off.
So, like, Brandon, I know what you're trying to do. You think you're,
but
think
it got your blood going.
Sometimes, yeah, that's not hard. That's
not hard. It got your blood going. So I highly recommend give Matt a follow and definitely check out The Prevailing Narrative. He's got a wonderful back catalog of episodes that are relevant today. I remember you interviewed Peter Navarro, one of your first interviews.
Navarro, he
might be looking at some time.
Looking at some time, man. That feels like a lifetime ago now. Yeah. In terms of that universe, I had Rick Grinnell as well. And it looks like
everything from across politics and finance and current events.
For sure.
And a lot. Pop culture.
And a lot of social sciences, and one topic that I didn't even, you know, I'm not trying to dictate everything. I'm also looking at what market information comes in. I mean, I talk a lot about mental health, but not just mental health in terms of the very cliched, oh, here's how to improve your mental health. Also, how society's dealing with mental health.
Yeah.
I've had a few episodes on that, and they've been particularly popular. And I do think I have a unique perspective on where we're going wrong in talking about mental health, in our approach, in how society has kind of made it just another social media campaign topic that's really not serving a lot of people. And I've done a few episodes on that. And that was my last one at the end of last year with a psychologist named J.D. Haltigen, super smart guy. And I've had a few of those. So, you know, if you're just poking around The Prevailing Narrative, you know, maybe go check out some of those episodes.
Really. Check it out. Like I said, you might not agree with them, but it's hard to ignore them. So
thank you, sir.
Check out The Prevailing Narrative. Matt, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I could not have navigated this by myself. Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Devil Within. You can find us on socials at The Devil Within Pod, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and available wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, stay safe. The Devil Within, A Season in Hell, is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.
Hey there. I'm Amara Kofer, and I'm the host of the show Black Girl Gone. In this podcast, I tell the stories of missing and murdered Black women and women of color in America. I want to bring light and awareness to all of these powerful stories. I focus on a neglected demographic and missing and murdered cases and send my love and respect to the victims. I recommend listening to Black Girl Gone on the iHeart app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.